And good afternoon. We'll wait for this to load. The miracle of technology. I love it when it works. As Pamela mentioned, I am the U.S. representative to the Public Services International project on the international migration of women workers in the health sector. PSI is a global federation for public sector trade unions. It has 650 affiliates in 150 countries representing more than 20 million public sector workers, the majority of which are in the health sector. PSI decided to do some research on the topic of migration in the health sector. And as a result of that research and what they found, they launched this project, which has been going on now for approximately 3 years. You can get a full synopsis of this research at their website, which is listed at the top of this slide, and I would highly suggest that you visit it. Not only does it have the results of the research, but a lot of other information, not only on migration, but on PSI's project on migration as well. Very quickly, the research findings were this, that 93% of all healthcare workers would prefer to stay in their home country if they could just earn a living wage. That poor working conditions are prevalent, especially in these developing countries. That international recruitment, private recruitment, has really increased in the last few years, and they see that as threatening their protections. That in those cases, in countries where some type of health reform has actually been carried out, healthcare workers were not involved in this. Shortages, of course, contribute to the reduced care that they're able to provide. That when health workers, especially women, do migrate, they're subjected to racial and gender discrimination, and that there's a high cost of migration on health workers, and especially women health workers, who are forced often to leave their families at home while they go off to another country in order to support them. Of course, migration is nothing new. This is not something that we've seen happen just in the last few years. Filipino nurses have been migrating since the 1950s, and the United States has been importing nurses for about as long. But what we have been seeing is a steady increase in foreign recruitment to fill nurse vacancies, not only in the United States, but also in Canada, the UK, and other developed countries. In this country, we used to recruit less than 4,000 nurses internationally per year. In the year 2005, more than 15,000 nurses passed the national licensure test required to practice as an RN in this country. Simply put, U.S. employers just can't keep nationals, employed in their workforce. And so the shortage is being so-called solved by international recruitment. Nurses who are recruited into this country are primarily female and married. Their average age is 43. They tend to make more than nurses who are from this country, not because they're paid more, but because they tend to work more hours, whether voluntarily or involuntarily. The top five states where you'll find international nurses are California, New York, New Jersey, Florida, and Illinois. Mm-hmm. Right here in California, migrant nurses make up 29% of the nurse workforce. 72% work in hospitals, and about 60% of those nurses who do migrate to the United States eventually do become citizens. So why do we care about this? Well, like I said, in the 1990s, about 4% of nurses in the U.S. were foreign-born. By 2004, 14% of all nurses were from abroad. That in and of itself is not a problem. In 2002, a third of all new nurses hired in this country had come from other countries. Again, that's not a problem. What's a problem is that we have 97 nurses per 10,000 people in this country, and we are experiencing a shortage. Compare that to 47 per 10,000 in South Africa, 41 in the Philippines, 9 in Kenya, and 1 in India. Now, most of these countries actually provide nursing education through their government system. The government pays for it. So it's been estimated that the governments in these developing countries are actually subsidizing the industrialized world to the tune of about $500 million per year because of the education that they've given to these workers who then choose to leave the country. There are push and pull factors, which would seem pretty obvious. The push factors, those factors that push workers out of their home countries, are low compensation and benefits, family obligations. They're obligated, of course, to provide for their family, and they can't do that in their home country. Political instability, graft and corruption in their governments, poor working conditions, and no job security. Those factors that pull them to our country, of course, are the opposite things of what push them out: higher compensation and benefits packages, more job opportunities, more political, economic, and social stability, better living, and better working conditions. So when you think of a migrant nurse, generally the first thing that comes to a lot of people's minds is, well, they come from the Philippines. It seems that the Philippines has always had sort of this steady, unending supply of nurses. But the fact is that the Philippines is experiencing a huge shortage of nurses and other healthcare workers. 10% of the Philippine population is what's considered upper class. They have access to the finest medical facilities, which are all private, I might add. And in these facilities, they have plenty of staff. The fact is that 80% of the Filipino population is what's called lower class. And in fact, 40% of the population in the Philippines lives on less than $1 per day. Half of all Filipinos have actually never even seen a physician. The employment situation in the Philippines is dire. Not only do they have high unemployment and underemployment, but their entire financial strategy is to send people overseas to work. The president's target is to actually send 1 million Filipino citizens to other countries every year to find jobs. In 2002, they were sending almost 2,500 Filipino citizens to other countries, putting them on planes or putting them on boats, sending them to other countries every single day so that they could find work outside of their own country. Export of labor is actually the number one dollar-earning industry in the Philippines because they rely on those remittances that these workers send back home to their families. There's actually a government structure in place in the Philippines to deal with the outpouring, the outsourcing, if you will, of Filipino citizens to other countries. It's called the Philippine Overseas Employment Agency. And I actually visited this organization in Manila, and there were just hundreds of people just standing in line hoping that would be the day that they would actually get, you know, the okay and the plane ticket for them to actually leave and go to another country. And then on the other hand, the fact is the national government of the Philippines spends less than 1% of its annual budget on health care. So how much does a nurse make who's working in the Philippines? Well, she makes about $1.04 per hour, $180 per month. So, you know, if they have a chance of making $180 per month or coming to the United States and making $3,000 or $4,000 per month, you can see the push-pull factors there. Only 58% of nurses registered in the Philippines were actually employed in nursing. And of that 58%, 85% of those were actually working outside of their home country. So, of course, you know, always eager to make a buck, schools in the Philippines decided that, well, you know, the whole idea here is let's send nurses out to other countries. So in a matter of 10 months in 2003, there was almost 50% increase in the number of nursing schools in the country, from 251 in June 2003 to 370 in April 2004. By September 2005, they had reached 430. There's no government oversight. Basically, anyone can open a nursing school in the country. So they had schools that were training car mechanics who decided, oh, well, we need to get in on this, and so they opened a school of nursing. Yeah, makes perfect sense. The problem is, you know, what's happening to the quality of the nurses who are coming out of these schools, not only to deal with the Filipino population, but also to deal with the populations in the countries where they're being recruited to. Not only is the Philippines losing their nurses, they're losing their doctors. Because, of course, the doctors aren't making that much money in the Philippines either. They can actually make more working as a nurse in the developed world. So starting in 2000, but really taking off in 2003, doctors have started going to school in the Philippines to become nurses. In fact, there's one estimate that 80% of all public health physicians in the Philippines have left the country to work as nurses in the developed world. And so what's happening at home? Is there really this sort of steady supply of nurses, this unending supply of nurses in the Philippines that the rest of the world can draw upon? No. 200 hospitals have closed in the Philippines within the last 2 years, and 800 hospitals have partially closed. We talk about a nurse-to-patient ratio in hospitals here. On a general med-surg floor, we'd like for it to be 1 to 4, 1 to 6. There, they're looking at 1 to 40 or 60. It used to be 1 to 15 or 20, which, you know, of course, is still horrible in our viewpoint, but it's certainly much better than what they were dealing with in the past. 70% of Filipino deaths happen without a health professional in attendance. And, of course, as I mentioned before, you know, there's the whole social aspect of this, what's happening to the children who are now living at home with only one parent. I actually visited Davao Medical Center. It's in Mindanao. It's the largest acute care facility outside of Manila. It has 400 beds, but an average daily census of 600 to 700 people. And you might wonder, well, how could that possibly be? Well, it's because they share beds. The young nurse who's sitting there took me on a tour of their OB ward. And it was one large room, sort of like a high school gymnasium. It had no windows except for some little slits at the very top. 136 mothers in this room with 99 babies. They pushed these beds together so that they could lie widthwise on them, 3 to 4 mothers per 2 beds with their babies. There were no bassinets. There were no sheets on the mattresses. There were no pillows. So 136 mothers, 99 babies, and 2 nurses. The ICU, which in this country we should have one nurse for every 1, maybe 2 patients, in this hospital they had a 6-bed ICU with 32 patients and 1 nurse. So yes, there is a huge shortage of healthcare workers in the Philippines, and there is not an unending supply. So while, you know, we welcome these nurses who want to come to the United States, we have to think about what's the devastating effect to the health systems back in their home country. We've been recruiting from the Caribbean for years. Migration to and from the Caribbean is nothing new. It's been going on forever. But what's happening to the nurse supply in these countries? Well, as you can see, the vacancy rates here range from, you know, a doable 4.4% in St. Lucia to a 58% vacancy rate in Jamaica. A total average in the Caribbean is over 40% vacancy rate. So again, we're scrambling in this country with an 11 to 12% vacancy rate, but yet we're going to the Caribbean and taking their nurses even though they have a 40% vacancy rate. Now, the nurses there do make more money than those their counterparts in the Philippines. They make about $1,000 to $2,000 per month. Again, the Caribbean provides that nursing education for their nurses, the governments, and they feel that they're subsidizing, or they've calculated that they're subsidizing the United States, the UK, and Canada to the tune of $16 million every year because of the nurses that they're losing. When I was in Barbados, I toured Queen Elizabeth Hospital. It's called the Beacon of the Caribbean. It's supposed to be the finest hospital in the Caribbean. But there were wards that were closed because they just didn't have enough staff. They had an MRI machine, but they couldn't use it because it broke and no one knew how to fix it. They have a huge shortage of nurses in Barbados. But just so happens that I showed up there on orientation day, and this is how they're dealing with their shortage. They're recruiting nurses from the Philippines and from sub-Saharan Africa. They had nurses there from the Philippines and from Nigeria, and this was orientation day in the Caribbean. India is going to be the next Philippines. They've seen the model work in the Philippines, and they want to make it work in India. They want to start exporting nurses at the same level as they're doing in the Philippines because they want those remittances to come back home. Now, most nurses who are trained in government-funded programs in India do not meet the requirements to practice in the United States, but they are quickly remedying that. Right now, recruiters work with individual hospitals. They're not working with the government, and hospitals are making upwards of $47,000 per nurse placed in another country, and so they see this as a real money-making opportunity. And then, of course, there's China. China has 10 nurses for every 10,000 people. Now, remember, we have 97. They have 10. But they have no job security. Each nurse there gets a six-month contract. It's not a labor union contract. It's an individual contract. And then every 6 months, that contract comes up for renewal. So that nurse doesn't know how long they're going to have that job because their employer can just choose not to renew their contract for any reason. Their nurse salaries average about $3,000 per year, and in some strange twist, they actually have more physicians than they have nurses. So they really are experiencing a nurse shortage. They do have bilateral agreements right now with Singapore and Saudi Arabia, where they will specifically train nurses for export to those two countries. But what they really want to do is train nurses to come to the United States. However, in their current educational system, about 85 to 95% of nurses would not actually qualify to work as nurses in this country. But because the United States, you know, is experiencing this shortage and is certainly actively recruiting nurses from other countries, they've decided they're going to change their education system. They have three different types of educational programs for nurses in China. As you can see, in 2001, only about 6% or 6,500 nurses reached the bachelor level, which is the level that you would need to actually take the NCLEX in this country to practice as a nurse in this country. By 2010, they hope to increase not only their percentage up to 20%, but the actual numbers. So you're looking at an increase from 6,500 nurses per year to 33,000 nurses per year. Now, clearly, they're not going to hire those nurses. They're training them simply for one reason, and that is to export them. And then, of course, there's sub-Saharan Africa, which has 25% of the world's disease, but only 1.3% of the trained health workforce. Migration is taking its toll. I could read through all of this, but suffice it to say that every time one single healthcare professional leaves a country in sub-Saharan Africa, it has a profound effect. And actually, these slides are on the table in the back, so you can pick them up on your way out if you're interested in this. This is Kenyatta National Hospital in Nairobi. It's the largest hospital in the region. People from other countries come to this hospital to receive care. It has 2,000 beds. The average daily census is 5,000. Again, how do you fit 5,000 patients into 2,000 beds? You put two people or more to a bed. Now, in the average ward, they have 32 beds with 70 to 100 patients. One to two nurses, no support staff, no gloves, no masks, no medications, no monitors or IVs, no one is turned away. So basically what this is it's a place to go to die. The nurses there actually went on a three-day strike a few years ago because they wanted gloves. You know, something that we take for granted for the most part in this country. They actually went out on strike. So the government came back and said, okay, we hear you, we know you need these gloves, so we're going to give them to you. So come back to work. So they came back to work, and now what has happened? Well, the nurses have their gloves. They show up, and at the beginning of their shift every day, each nurse gets her one pair of gloves for the day. Now, they're losing these nurses and other workers largely because of aggressive recruiting. You know, like I said, we welcome these workers who want to come to the United States. They offer a great deal. But a lot of times it's because of aggressive recruiting. I don't know if you're familiar with the TV show 60 Minutes, but they did have an expose on this topic a little while ago. And they interviewed a recruiter who said he received $25,000 for every nurse that he signed up to come to the United States. A colleague of mine walked through a hospital in Botswana, and the head nurse there told her that they had to actually close down wings of their hospital after a recruiter came through and took her best and brightest and most experienced nurses to the United States. They no longer can accept AIDS patients in this hospital. So one thing that we've been working on through this PSI project is a voluntary code of ethical recruitment. What happened is Academy Health brought together stakeholders, including recruiters, the American Hospital Association, professional associations, and labor unions. And we came together and we fought and came up with a voluntary code of ethical recruitment. It was released September 4th, 2008, and it's not perfect, I think, from anybody's standpoint. You know, we would have liked some tougher restrictions on recruiters and some, you know, stronger protections for workers, and I'm sure that there are things that the hospitals and the recruiters would have liked as well. But all in all, it's something that we all can live with, and we think that it's a pretty good document. So I would encourage you to go to fairinternationalrecruitment.org. You can take a look at the actual document. We've had lots of different organizations sign on to it, including some of the largest international recruiters in this country. So what's happening to quality health care in this country as a result of this increase in international recruitment? What this is it's a chart showing the percent of nurses passing for the first time the NCLEX exam. And as you can see, you know, the Philippines is the nation where we're recruiting the largest number of nurses. They have a first-time pass rate of 55%. That might be because they're getting their nursing education from the car care college, but, you know, it's not a lot better in some of these other countries as well. So we do have to wonder, you know, are we getting the most qualified nurses and other health care workers, or is it just that we need a person in a position in a facility? And so, you know, if it says nurse after their name, we're willing to take them. What can our unions do? Well, like I said, we are very involved in the Public Services International project. Part of that has been educating workers in developing countries about what their rights are and what their options are. We want them to know that, you know, if you're offered $3,000 a month to come and work as a nurse in New York City, that may sound fabulous, but do you know how much rent is? Do you know that you're going to have to buy winter clothes? Do you know how cold it gets in New York City? Do you know how much bread costs and milk costs? Just the very basic things, you know. It's not just about the bottom line. They want to be able to send money back home to their families. Are they going to be able to do that? So we really want to educate them about what the pros and cons are for actually leaving their country. We want to protect the rights of all workers, both in their home country and in their host country. We want to fight against all forms of discrimination. Of course, you know, some nurses and other workers have great experiences when they migrate. And then, of course, there are those few really bad experiences that we hear about in the media a lot of times. We don't want to hear about any bad experiences in the media. We want to provide structured mentorship programs for migrant workers, and that's something that my union is actually working on doing right now, and I know that other unions have been involved in that as well. We want to work toward the Code of Ethical Recruitment, which we've already at least gotten started on in this country. The next phase of that actually is developing a monitoring board so that we can actually monitor what some of these recruitment agencies are doing and give them a report card, much like CMS has been doing with hospitals. We'd like to see government oversight of recruitment agencies, but given sort of our fractured healthcare system in this country, that probably won't happen. Continue fighting for better working conditions here in this country so that, you know, recruitment and retention of workers in our hospitals and health facilities won't be such a major problem. Investigating compensation schemes. A lot of countries would like for the United States to reimburse them for the money that they've spent educating nurses that then choose to leave their country. Again, because of our fragmented healthcare system, you know, trying to compensate another country for that would be very difficult. Who would do the compensation? Would it be our government? Would it be the individual employer? Would it be the recruiter? Those are all types of things, you know, that would need to be worked out, and I'm not sure how feasible that is, but it's something to look at. We need to work to get donor money available for wages in some of these countries. You know, we have ARVs available in some African countries, but they're just sitting in a warehouse because they don't actually have the workers or they don't have the workers employed to actually administer them. And, you know, finally, just continue to work on GATS, especially Mode 4, to protect the practice of nursing in every country. And so I just would leave you with this thought from a pediatric nurse in Nairobi who said, "We would prefer to stay home, but there is no choice. We have to go." Thanks.
We have time for a couple of questions for Joni. Please.
Yes, thank you for your question. That is something that my union's been very active in, and we definitely support increasing funds for training in our own country. We'd like to see GME reimbursement rates increased, and of course, any type of help for nurse education that we can get. The problem with that right now is that we actually have a shortage of nurse faculty in this country. So even though we have qualified applicants to nursing schools, they're being turned away because we just don't have the faculty. So the first thing we have to do is get the government involved in training and retaining nursing faculty in this country so that we can actually train nurses and try, you know. Then, of course, the problem is keeping them. Once they're trained, they get into the workplace, they realize it's not what they thought it was, and they leave. And we find that the retention rate for new grads in nursing especially has been very poor. But it is something that we are looking into and very supportive of.
Is there another question for Joni? Well, if not, then thank you, Joni, for that really very stunning presentation about the effects of nurse migration. We're going to move on to our second presentation. And this paper is entitled "Health Tourism to India: Challenges Against Resource Compensation to Sustaining a Viable Public Health Infrastructure for the Local Populace." And it's given by Jack Warren Salmon and Meghana Aruhu. And I'll tell you a little bit about both of them before they give their presentation. Jack Salmon is a professor of health policy and administration in the School of Public Health. He was professor and former head in the pharmacy administration in the College of Pharmacy, professor of public policy analysis in the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs, and adjunct professor of medical education in the College of Medicine at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He began the UIC Medical Care Pharmacy Residency, the first such preparatory program in the nation then, and coordinated a Novartis Pharmacoeconomics Fellowship Program and was an Abbott's Lab HIV/AIDS Clinical Research Fellowship Program at UIC. He served as faculty advisor to the UIC Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy, student chapter and the first and largest such entity among the nation's colleges of pharmacy. Previously, he was professor and coordinator of the health policy and planning specialization in the UIC School of Urban Planning and Policy. In January 2008, he retired from full-time teaching at UIC, but retains a professorship in the School of Public Health. He currently serves as an adjunct professor in the International Graduate Program in Social Administrative Pharmacy at the University of Bangkok in Thailand. Meghana Aruhu has a bachelor's degree in pharmacy and a master's in business administration. She's currently a PhD candidate in the Pharmacy Administration Department at UIC, and she's presented at APHA in previous years on medical and pharmaceutical outsourcing. She's very interested in global health initiatives, in patient safety, and in health policy. Please join me in welcoming these presenters.
Thank you, Pamela. Let's get this going.